decided to count my daily walk or cross-country ski as a treat, my time for myself in a day otherwise filled with responsibilities. Somehow, that made it much easier to make it a priority. The treats of childhood retain a special power. As a child, I was rarely allowed to drink soda or to buy a book instead of checking it out from the library. What do I do now with abandon? Drink diet soda and buy books. The book-buying treat is wholly separate from the library-visiting treat. So perhaps we parents need to think hard about what we identify as treats for our children. A friend thought she should renounce her treat. "I really love coffee, but I know I should stop drinking it," she told me. "Why?" I pressed. "Does it keep you up at night? Does it make your stomach hurt?" "No, it doesn't affect me." I couldn't resist launching into a defense of coffee. You need some treats, and as treats go, coffee is great. Even if you buy very expensive coffee, it's not that expensive in absolute terms. It boosts your energy and focus. If you don't add anything crazy, it doesn't have any sugar, carbs, fat, or calories, but it does have antioxidants, vitamins, minerals, and even fiber. Weird as that sounds. Caffeine is fine if you're drinking it in the human range. Plus, there's pleasant ritual connected with it. You can go out for coffee with a friend. "But I drink so much. I should at least cut back." "But why?" I pressed. "Enjoy it." Samuel Johnson said, "All severity that does not tend to increase good or prevent evil is idle. A habit isn't bad unless it causes some kind of problem." I don't think I convinced her. Putting time, money, or energy towards treats may be easier or harder, depending on a person's tendency. Rebels readily give themselves treats. As an upholder, I have a strong sense of self-preservation, and I'll say to myself, "I'm at the end of my rope. I'm going to stop working and read Jung's Memories, Dreams, Reflections for an hour." Because they want to have good reasons for their actions, some questioners may be more willing to give themselves treats if they believe that getting treats isn't frivolous or arbitrary. For instance, a questioner might benefit from thinking, "I'm getting a massage, which increases immune function," or "I'll go to the football game with my brother, and that will strengthen our family ties." Other questioners like to consider treats as investments. A questioner wrote, "I'm getting a haircut at the expensive place, not the $20 place, because having a professional cut and color helps my career. Maybe a little bit just because I like it so much better." To be sure, some questioners may conclude that "because I want to" is a sufficient justification for a treat. Obligers, by contrast, may have trouble giving themselves treats if they feel that the time, energy, or money is more properly owed to someone else. But it's important for obligers to have treats. They're susceptible to burnout, and too many moments of self-deprivation or too much work for the benefit of others may lead them to feel resentful, neglected, or deprived. Touching on obliger rebellion, one obliger wrote, "I don't give myself treats, finding it much easier to give treats to others. Every so often, however, a level of anger surfaces. I have no problem treating myself when I'm in these rare times of obliger resistance." Another obliger explained how he uses his obliger character to convince himself to enjoy at least one regular treat. "I'm reluctant to give myself treats, but happy to provide treats to others. I just never feel right taking that time away from the other things and people that I'm responsible for. I do manage to take one night a week for myself. I'm a member of a skating team, which is a classic obliger thing to do, as I wouldn't get out if people weren't counting on me." Framing a treat in terms of its benefit to others is a good way for obligers to manage to give themselves treats. "If I spend a few hours playing golf, I'll be more patient at home and at work." A reader wrote, "I just spent more on a makeup product than I have in my entire life because I recently resolved to pay more attention to my appearance. I decided to do this because I thought it would help me feel more attractive, which would be good for my marriage. Notice that the ultimate goal is improving my relationship, not just feeling better for my own sake." people who are around obligers can help ward off obliger burnout and obliger rebellion by encouraging them to treat themselves healthfully and by providing external accountability to make sure they follow through. You said you wanted to take a nap, and you'll be irritable if you don't. Go lie down. We won't expect to see you for an hour. The four tendencies may have different views about whether to schedule treats regularly or whether to indulge in spontaneous treats. As an upholder, I prefer a scheduled treat. I like being able to anticipate and depend on getting that treat. A rebel prefers a spontaneous treat. A questioner would follow whatever course would enhance the pleasure of the treat. An obliger would need external accountability to get that treat, which would usually require scheduling. By helping us to feel energetic and happy, healthy treats can play a key role in fostering good habits. But we must guard against the temptations of unhealthy treats. The pleasure lasts a minute, but then feelings of guilt, regret, loss of control, and other negative consequences kick in. A reader posted on my Facebook page, "My treats are never good for me. If I'm feeling good, I think I deserve something that's not good for me. If I'm feeling bad, I think I deserve something that's not good for me." Another reader added, "Skipping class is a treat that has a bad effect on me. I do it to feel better, but it makes me feel so much worse." Three categories of treats, in particular, are dangerous. First, food. Indulging feels good for a moment, but it may leave us feeling worse in the long run. One study found that women are more likely to eat chocolate when feeling anxious or depressed, but this treat just makes them feel more guilty. People who struggle with their relationship to food may do better to find non-food treats, period. Second, shopping. For many people, shopping is a treat. Perhaps surprisingly, research suggests that people are more likely to impulse shop when they're feeling good than when they're feeling bad. Shopping is a chance to have a small adventure, to enjoy the world by looking, touching, tasting, and smelling, to feel the thrill of the hunt, the bargain, and the crossed-off items on the to-do list. However, spending too much time or money on shopping can make people feel worse. Some manage to enjoy an anxiety-free shopping treat by limiting themselves to window shopping or bargain hunting at flea markets or garage sales. A reader wrote, "I do sometimes sport shop for entertainment or relaxation or emotional pickup. I set a money limit before going into a store to browse." Another reader fills up her online cart, then abandons it without making a purchase. One reader posted, "I pop into an antique store while I am out running errands. I almost never buy anything, but stylishly arranged stores with beautiful things are such pleasant places, like small art museums." Another explained, "I shop online a lot, sometimes too much. Recently, if I see something I like, I will pin it to a Pinterest board instead of buying it right away. This often satisfies the need to buy the item and gives me the small jolt of happiness that comes along with getting something new. Just knowing I've saved it somewhere is satisfying." But as with food, people who struggle to curb their spending may do better to find non-retail activities. The third category of dangerous treats? Screen time, particularly television, however viewed. Americans spend about half their leisure hours watching TV. Although I don't watch much TV, I'm determined to keep it a treat instead of a default activity, which it can become all too easily. Television stays a treat, I concluded, if I anticipate with pleasure watching a particular show. I'm not just flipping through the channels. I watch with someone else. I turn off the TV when the episode is over. I feel energized, not listless, when the episode is over. Screens of all kinds tend to drain energy if used too long. They consume time that could be spent in other activities. They make it easy to stay up too late. They make it easy to eat mindlessly. Technology is a good servant, but a bad master, like habit itself. Although treats make it easier to stick to good habits, if we make a habit of a treat, it may stop feeling like a treat. In Treat Creep, A rare treat gradually turns ordinary, or a small indulgence grows larger over time. Philosopher Immanuel Kant permitted himself only one pipe per day, but as years passed, his pipe bowls became much larger. Taking a bath with fancy bath salts once a week is a treat. Taking that bath every day might make it a background activity of life. I can tear through all of the magazines in my stack, one right after the other, or I can dole them out as treats. Things can be part of an ordinary day, or we can consider them treats. Of course, whether a particular habit is good or bad is a matter of opinion. If you're cultivating good habits, a friend told me, you should give up your habit of drinking so much diet soda. Nope, I answered, I don't consider it a bad habit. Regular soda is terrible, but I never touch the regular stuff. It can't be good for you. Well, I said with a shrug, I don't smoke, I hardly drink, I eat low carb, and I don't believe that diet soda is harmful. Would I be better off drinking plain water? Maybe. But this is my treat. Perhaps because of my upholder nature, marching through my daily calendar sometimes feels like an energy-boosting treat. One day, in fact, my sister said to me, I had an epiphany. You would have made a great monk. Elizabeth knows me very well. It's so strange that you say that, I replied. Just last week, I was reading the Rule of Saint Benedict. This extraordinarily influential, thousand-year-old guide sets out the rules for monks living in monasteries. I love the monastic approach to the day. Every hour with its own name and its own activity, all laid out. Not everyone, e.g., certainly no rebel, is attracted by the idea of having each day ordered, but I love the monkish orarium, or table of hours, the highly specific routine that runs on an annual cycle, with variations for the days of the week and the seasons. Every part of the day has its own character and purpose, with time set aside for prayer, manual work, rest, eating, sleeping. Few decisions, no hurry, time for everything. I was particularly intrigued by the hours that monks set aside for Lectio Divina, or spiritual reading. This is another kind of treat. To be happy, even we non-monks need to make time for transcendent matters, such as beauty, creativity, service, faith. But too often these get pushed aside for more urgent demands, and life begins to feel empty and purposeless. Scheduling Lectio Divina is a way to make sure that the spiritual gets attention. Whether a person decides to read holy books and attend religious services, as a monk would do, or adapts this habit to make regular time to leaf through art books, read biographies of great figures, spend time in nature, go to concerts, volunteer, or meditate. For some people, politics is a spiritual concern tied to transcendent values such as justice, opportunity, and freedom. And from what I've observed, sports seems to have a spiritual value for some people, with its aspects of devotion, loyalty, hope, and perseverance. Once we've truly adopted a habit, it comes easily, without decision-making. But until that point, and many habits, alas, can never be completely taken for granted, giving ourselves a little boost with treats helps us maintain our self-command. Goethe pointed out, whatever liberates our spirit without giving us mastery over ourselves is destructive. And whatever liberates our spirit while giving us mastery over ourselves is constructive. Sitting is the new smoking. Pairing. In the acquisition of a new habit, or the leaving off of an old one, we must take care to launch ourselves with as strong and decided an initiative as possible. Never suffer an exception to occur till the new habit is securely rooted in your life. Each lapse is like the letting fall of a ball of string which one is carefully winding up. A single slip undoes more than a great many turns will wind again. William James, Psychology, Briefer Course. For me, the strategy of pairing was such a familiar approach to habit formation that it took me a long time to notice it. I'd used it often in my own life, and it came so naturally to me that I didn't give it much thought. When I happened to mention it, however, people responded with so much interest and enthusiasm that I realized it deserved to be studied as its own strategy. In the strategy of pairing, I couple two activities, one that I need or want to do, and one that I don't particularly want to do, to get myself to accomplish them both. It's not a reward. It's not a treat. It's just a pairing. For example, I'd briefly explained the strategy of pairing to an acquaintance, and a few months later, she reported that it had transformed her habits. "I have to tell you," she said with enthusiasm, "thanks to what you said, I've been going to the gym regularly. It's amazing. I could never get myself to go, and now I go all the time." "Really?" I said, pleased that she was giving me credit, even if undeserved, for this before and after. Remind me, what exactly did you try?" "I'm using the strategy of pairing. Now I watch certain TV shows only while I work out. That's why I go. I want to go to the gym, because I have all these shows I'm addicted to." "Excellent," I said. "Are you ever tempted to sneak in an episode at home, too?" "No, because I know that if I did it once, I'd do it all the time. Only at the gym is my rule." I was sick for a few days, and I thought, I can't go to the gym, and I'm just lying here, so wouldn't it be okay to watch my show? But I didn't let myself. I've used pairing to help me stick to the habit of exercise myself. Although I've shaped myself into a dedicated, if low-intensity, exerciser, I still sometimes feel the pull of my couch potato nature, and pairing helps me keep my gym habits strong. I love reading magazines, and Jamie and I still subscribe to lots of old-fashioned print magazines, 19 the last time I counted, and I allow myself to read them only at the gym, when I'm on the cardio machines. The fact that I can easily read magazines while I exercise may suggest that I'm not exercising very hard. And I'm not, but at least I'm showing up. My sister does the same thing with her home treadmill and the Real Housewives shows. "It really makes me want to do the treadmill," she explained. During college, I used pairing to get myself to exercise. I wouldn't let myself take a shower unless I'd exercised. I'd go a day, or maybe two, without a shower, but pretty soon I really wanted that shower. Pairing can work in all kinds of circumstances. When I lived in San Francisco after college, I took a good walk every morning because I bought my morning bagel from a bagel store half a mile from my apartment. If I wanted the bagel, I had to go for the walk. I find it much more satisfying to walk with a purpose, to go to a favorite coffee shop, to hike to the top of a mountain. I know someone who does car praying. He says his daily prayers during his commute home from work. Someone else watches TED Talks while shaving. A friend who travels frequently for work has a rule that she never works on an airplane. She only reads novels. That habit makes her business travel much more fun, and she keeps the habit of reading. A reader wrote, "I do commercial cleaning. When a commercial comes on, I do a chore. Wash 6 dishes, put a load in the dryer, dust the dining room. Once the commercials are over, I sit down again. It's amazing how I can get so much done in little spurts. Plus, I don't consider myself such a slug at the end of the day." A man told me that he keeps his pillbox next to the coffee maker and doesn't allow himself to make his morning coffee until he's taken his daily medication. No surprise, upholders and questioners find the strategy of pairing easier to use than the other tendencies do. Depending on the situation, obligers may find it difficult to use this strategy because there's no external accountability. There's no one to say, "Nope, you can't make coffee until you've taken your medicine." Nevertheless, some obligers do seem to be able to use it successfully. Rebels are unlikely to try this approach. I'm always on the alert for exciting new habit formation ideas, and my friends often pitch me their favorites. A highly organized friend suggested a pairing. Give my habit a try, she told me. When I walk from one room to another at home, I carry something with me. I don't put it away, necessarily. I just move it closer to its destination. But how will that make a difference? I asked, skeptical. You'll see. She sounded so confident that I decided to give it a shot. And this simple pairing, walking and carrying, is surprisingly effective. Things get put away much more easily, without a lot of special effort or extra trips. I'm walking from the bedroom to the kitchen, so I bring my giant mug. I'm walking from the front door to my bedroom, so I bring the book that needs to be shelved. It seems like a small thing, but it definitely cuts down on the clutter in my apartment. Pairing provides the satisfaction of multitasking, since, by definition, two things are getting done at once. A friend emailed me soon after she started using the Nike Fuel Band. If I spend a half hour in the park with my dog in the morning, I want it to be useful in addition to just exercising the dog, and now I'm more conscious of how many steps I'm taking. I also started listening to audiobooks while walking the dog, so now I'm making that time count in three ways. We can also use the strategy of pairing to discourage ourselves from following an undesirable habit. We might pair eating with the civilized habit of sitting down at a table, which means not eating directly from a container, and not eating at a desk, in the car, on the street, or standing in front of the fridge. If I watched TV by myself, I might binge-watch through a favorite series in a few nights. But because I only allow myself to watch those shows with Jamie, and Jamie refuses to watch more than one episode at a time, I never forsake all life responsibilities in order to watch TV. I looked for other ways to apply the strategy of pairing. First, as part of my ongoing effort to move more, to strengthen my foundation, I'd been trying to go for a long walk each weekend, but it felt like a real burden. One of my 12 personal commandments is, identify the problem. What was the problem? I got bored during those walks. I decided to pair my walks with time with friends and emailed two friends to suggest a regular walking date. Both were game. One friend can go only occasionally, the other can go more regularly, though it usually takes a few emails to set up. I actually don't mind the slight logistical hassle. Because the walks aren't quite predictable, they feel more like a treat. Over time, in fact, I realized that although I'd formed this habit to get more exercise, it's actually more important as a habit pair to strengthen my relationships. The time with a friend is more valuable than the steps logged on my Up Band. Nevertheless, I couldn't always walk with company. Eleanor listens to audiobooks all the time, mostly the Harry Potter books, the Little House books, the Narnia books, and a history series called The Story of the World. And inspired by her example, I bought the audiobooks of Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy. Listening to these books made me so happy. Once I even walked an extra 5 blocks, just to listen longer. I wanted to do more walking and less sitting. As a writer, I spend most of my day in a chair, but I'm so restless that I imagined that I was getting on my feet a reasonable amount. To get something to drink or eat, or to go to the bathroom, or to check something in a book. However, when I set my Up Band to vibrate whenever I sit still for 45 minutes, I learned that I was doing a lot more sitting than I'd assumed. This matters because studies suggest that plain old sitting is a bad habit. Sitting is the new smoking. Studies show that the average American sits for at least 8 hours a day, and while we sit, our metabolism changes for the worse. Sitting for several hours a day seems to raise people's risk of early death, even for people who exercise. Plus, I noticed that walking around boosted my concentration and energy level. To combat oversitting, I decided to pair talking on the phone with standing. If I want to use the phone, I must stand. For years, I've wanted a treadmill desk, a treadmill with a desk on it, so that I could walk while on the computer or phone, but my office is too tiny to hold one, so standing is the next best thing. I don't talk on the phone a lot, but often enough that this pairing means that I do add a fair amount of movement to my days. Pairing is effective, sometimes too effective. it's easy to allow a bad habit to form by creating a pair. Some familiar bad habit pairs? I always get drunk on Saturday nights. I always read an email as soon as I get it. I always go shopping when I'm traveling. Once the pair is formed, breaking it up feels like deprivation. A friend loved eating candy at the movies so much that when she decided to change her eating habits, she had to quit going to the movies. Another friend had paired his morning cup of coffee with a cigarette, so when he decided to quit smoking, he switched to tea. But just as pairing can create bad habits, it can also be used to contain a bad habit. A reporter told me, "I had a bad habit in college. Every time I finished an exam, I let myself eat a croissant. I love croissants." "But that sounds okay," I said. "It's a good pair, because you got to have croissants sometimes, but since you didn't take that many exams, you didn't get them often. It was self-limiting. It's not like you were going to take an extra exam just to get another croissant. You figured out a way to stay in control of your croissant habit." True. Also, taking an exam is no fun, but this pairing made it more pleasant. I'd been thinking about the power of the strategy of pairing, and at one point, I had an inspiration. Few things bring me as much pure happiness as encouraging someone to form a good habit, and I can occasionally be a bit pushy about it. So I'm sure my long-suffering sister wasn't surprised to see an email pop up in her inbox. I wrote, "As you know, I've long been obsessed with treadmill desks. I want one desperately, but alas, can't fit one in my office and still be able to open the door. A bit of a drawback. However, you should get one. I visited my friend AJ to see his treadmill desk. He said he works on it all the time. He got used to it very quickly and loves it. Says he feels so much more energetic, feels sluggish on the days when he can't use it. He walks 7 miles most days, and he walks very slowly. It's very quiet, less noise than an AC. The fact is, it's very tough for you to exercise these days. You've got a lot on your plate, and you're only going to get more. This might be a way to cross exercise off your to-do list without even noticing it. While you work, you walk. I would love to buy this for you. I never did get you a birthday present. Please consider it. I wish I had the gumption just to order it and beg your assistant to help get it situated in your office, but I fear that springing a treadmill desk on someone is like giving them a kitten they didn't ask for. Think about it." My sister replied, "What an amazing offer. Let me ponder." Several hours later, I got another email from her with a report not just about her decision, but also about that of her longtime writing partner and co-showrunner, Sarah. She wrote, "So, drum roll, with much excitement and gratitude, I'm accepting your incredibly generous gift. I truly think this treadmill desk is gonna be a game changer. It's exactly what I need. I've already told everyone at work I plan to become an obnoxious bore on the subject." Another drum roll. Sarah has decided to get one too. She said she can't lounge on a couch while I'm walking all day. Our plan is to put the two treadmill desks in my office in front of a whiteboard. We'll keep two mini desks in her office. We're convinced we're going to lead a major TV writer trend. Thank you. I love it already. Less than a week later, both treadmills had arrived, and I called Elizabeth to hear the report. "So," I demanded, "how is it?" "It's really great," she said. "We used them all day." "Was it hard to get used to it?" "Not at all," she said. "We were in my office a lot, rewriting a script, so I was walking for about 3.5 hours. I wasn't going fast, sometimes as slow as 0.8 miles per hour, but I still walked 4.55 miles in total. I'll be able to go faster when I'm more used to it, and depending on what I'm doing." "More than 4.5 miles? That's great," I said. "I'm really into the distance. Sarah's really into the number of steps. As soon as she saw the number of steps she was walking, she instantly took to it. We're going to keep track and see how far we go." "You could track it on a map. Like, We've walked to San Francisco. So satisfying. Yes, she said. Already I feel very righteous, seeing the numbers mount up. Plus, it makes work much better. Our notes call with the studio about the script lasted 40 minutes, and I walked the whole time. And on top of that, I told Sarah that I thought we'd snack less if we were on the treadmill. That makes sense, I said. People are sensitive to the slightest bit of inconvenience. Having to get off the treadmill makes it that much harder to run to the kitchen. How do you feel? My legs definitely got tired, but I think I'll adjust. The most important thing, though, is whether it will help lower my A1C level. For me, it's all about the blood sugar. After some time passed, I checked in with Elizabeth again. She'd instantly embraced the habit of the treadmill desk and was logging about 5 miles daily. She still didn't know exactly how it was affecting the all-important A1C level, because this test had to be done in her doctor's office. Last time, my A1C level was terrible, Elizabeth told me, and bringing that number down is the most important thing for me. If the treadmill desk deals with that, it's a game changer, especially for people who have type 2 diabetes. I'm surprised people aren't issued treadmill desks, because compared to the cost of medicine and doctor visits, they're a bargain. Or I'd think that Google-type companies would offer them to their employees. Plus, it helps with stress. When things blew up at work, I reacted better than I would have otherwise. And when I leave work, I know that no matter what else did or didn't happen, I've walked 5 miles. Until Elizabeth got the treadmill desk, she hadn't been able to make a habit of exercise. Now that she could use the strategy of pairing, bolstered by the strategies of convenience, monitoring, and foundation, the habit kicked in hard. Also, Elizabeth is an obliger. She told me, I realized that it's easier for me to exercise when it feels like obligation to my diabetes. Once again, I saw that when people frame their habits in the way that makes the most sense to them, they succeed better. It would never occur to me to characterize exercise as an obligation to diabetes, but I could immediately see why that formation resonated with her. Because of her health issues, getting more exercise was a truly significant habit for Elizabeth, and I was thrilled that I'd helped her to form that habit. But sometimes it struck me that my preoccupation with the subject of habits was petty. Was it ridiculous to devote so much time to thinking about how to eat better or sleep more or clear out my to-do list faster? Life was too solemn, too splendid to be frittered away in such trivial concerns. But while concentrating on my habits might seem small-minded, in the end, mastering those habits would allow me to put those questions out of my mind, to transcend them. I could turn all my attention to worthier matters and yet be assured of the solidity of the architecture of my everyday life. These small everyday actions had their own value. The pressure of my daily habits would mold my future. These habits were little things on their own, but their combined weight was massive. I thought again of one of my favorite lines from Samuel Johnson. It is by studying little things that we attain the great art of having as little misery and as much happiness as possible. Unique, just like everyone else. As the saying goes, I'm unique, just like everyone else. While we can learn about ourselves by looking in a mirror, as in the self-knowledge section, we also learn about ourselves by considering ourselves in comparison to others. This section encompasses the strategies of clarity, identity, and other people, which, by placing us in the context of other people, illuminate our individual values, interests, and temperament. And when we understand ourselves better, we can do a better job of shaping our habits. Choose my bale of hay. Clarity. People pay for what they do, and still more, for what they have allowed themselves to become. And they pay for it very simply, by the lives they lead. James Baldwin, No name in the street. One of the great puzzles of habit is the fact that some habits form too easily, while others don't seem to stick. Why? There are many answers, but sometimes, I realized, the problem is a lack of clarity. I feel ambivalent. I want to do something, but I also don't want to do it. Or I want one thing, but I also want something else that conflicts with it. Or everyone seems to agree that some habit is important, but it's not important to me. It took me a long time to grasp the importance of the strategy of clarity. I'm always eager to focus on the concrete, and clarity seems somewhat abstract. But it turns out that clarity is an extremely important element of habits, and extremely practical, too. Two kinds of clarity support habit formation: clarity of values and clarity of action. The clearer I am about what I value and what action I expect from myself, not what other people value or expect from me, the more likely I am to stick to my habits. Research suggests that when we have conflicting goals, we don't manage ourselves well. We become anxious and paralyzed, and we often end up doing nothing. When I reflected on the habits that I'd struggled with over the years, I realized how often my hesitation and backsliding were due to the lack of clarity. Should I use free time on school day mornings to work on my emails or to read aloud to Eleanor? Should I work every Saturday afternoon, or should I devote that time to leisure? Should I encourage Eliza to do her homework in the kitchen, in the company of the family, or should she study in her room, away from noise and distractions? I feel ambivalent, and my uncertainty about these competing claims depletes my energy. Like Bearden's ass, the donkey that starves because it can't decide between two bales of hay, I become paralyzed by indecision. As I talk to people about habits and happiness, certain pairs of conflicting values kept cropping up. For example, I want to give 110% to work, versus I want to give 110% to my family. I want to work on my novel versus I want to exercise. I want to get more sleep versus I want some time each day to talk to my sweetheart, watch TV, and have fun. I want to spend less time in the car versus I want my children to participate in many after-school activities. I want to be very accessible to other people versus I want time alone to think and work. I want to be frugal versus I want to join a gym. I want some time to relax when I get home from work versus I want to live in a house that's clean and orderly. I want to meet new people and see my friends versus I want more solitude. I want to plan for the future by saving for retirement versus I want to enjoy the present by traveling. I want to drink less versus I want to be the life of the party. As these pairs demonstrate, often when we experience a lack of clarity, it's because two important values conflict. They're both important, so we agonize about which value to honor in the habits we pursue. When I face values that seem to conflict, I first remind myself to consider whether this conflict might be a false choice. Can I choose both? A mother in Eleanor's class told me, I couldn't go to my exercise class because my son wanted me to read to him. She seemed pleased with herself, and I imagine she thought, I'm willing to sacrifice my own desires to be attentive to my son. I suspect she's an obliger. Though I gave a non-committal response, to me, that seemed like a false choice. I wanted to say, being a good parent is a very high value. But what value should be served in that particular situation? Maybe you can exercise and read to your son by reading to him during a non-exercise time. When we push ourselves to get clarity, when we identify the problem, sometimes we spot new solutions. I heard about a couple who went to marriage counseling because they were fighting constantly about chores and whether a clean house or ample leisure time was more important. They kept arguing until they decided to quit marriage counseling and spend the money on a weekly cleaning service. A friend loves taking long bike rides on the weekends, but he also wants to spend time with his family. For a long time, whatever he did with his day, he wished he'd done something else. When he pushed himself to state plainly the nature of the conflict, he saw a solution. On Saturdays and Sundays, he gets up at 5 a.m., rides for 6 hours, and spends the rest of the day at home. It's easier to stick to a habit when we see, with clarity, the connection between the habit and the value it serves. I make my bed because I know that the habit makes me feel calmer. I give my daughters hello and goodbye kisses because that habit makes me feel more loving. It's probably true that the worldly values of pleasure, vanity, and fastidiousness are just as persuasive as higher values. I bet more people brush their teeth to prevent bad breath than to prevent cavities. A fitness trainer told me, "Men tend to come in because they want to improve a skill, like their tennis game, or regain something they've lost, like being able to walk upstairs without puffing. Women want to look better. Everyone adds health justifications later." When it's not apparent that a habit has value, people are less likely to follow it. People often stop taking their medication when they don't see an obvious connection between the medicine and their condition, as sometimes happens with people taking medication for high blood pressure. Although I'd always vaguely intended to get the flu vaccine as a family, we never did until Elizabeth learned that her diabetes might have been triggered by a bad case of the flu. A few days of the flu vaccines didn't seem worth the bother. Risk of diabetes? We get the vaccine every year. Clarity is one reason that the strategy of scheduling is so helpful. It's important to have time to write, to have time with my family, to read. Instead of spending my day in a chaos of warring priorities and feeling as though whatever I do, I'm leaving important things undone, I can use the clarity of scheduling to guarantee that I have time and energy to devote to each activity that matters. Clarity also helps shine a spotlight on aspects of ourselves that we may wish to conceal. We should pay special attention to any habit that we try to hide. The desire to prevent family members or coworkers from acting as witnesses, from seeing what's on the computer screen, or knowing how much time or money we're spending on a habit, is a clue that in some way our actions don't reflect our values. One reader wrote, "I go on secret shopping sprees and hide the bags in the storage room. I don't want anyone to know what I spent." One way to attack a hidden bad habit, secret smoking, secret shopping, secret monitoring of an ex-sweetheart on Facebook, is to force it into public view. We may choose to give up the habit if we can't keep it secret. Or we may be reassured to realize that others share our habit. One reader wrote, "My secret habit was watching the Hallmark Channel. I confessed, laughing but embarrassed, to a friend, and she said, 'Me too.'" True, we might hide a habit for other reasons. A reader posted, "I'm a closet writer. Whenever anyone asks me what I've been up to, I never tell them that writing a novel is occupying half my time. I somehow feel dishonest, but there's something about telling people I'm writing that makes me feel overly exposed." Many people keep secret blogs. We should also pay special attention to anything we feel compelled to explain. Paradoxically, unnecessary self-justification can be a feature of denial. Once I found myself telling Jamie about the many reasons that I hadn't gotten any work done that day, though he didn't care how much or how little work I'd completed. When I stopped talking, I realized that my desire to explain myself to him stemmed from a need to hide something from myself. I didn't want to admit that I'd violated my work habits. A friend told me a poignant story. "I got in line at the grocery store," he recounted, "and I realized that I knew the woman ahead of me. She didn't notice me, and before I could say anything, she started a conversation with the cashier. She pointed to the food she was buying, really junky food like chips, frozen blintzes, cookies, and said, 'My kids make me buy all this stuff. They love it.' 'But she doesn't have any kids. She doesn't even have a cat.' I felt so bad about overhearing it that I switched lines." In Tori Johnson's memoir, The Shift, she writes, From the day I got my driver's license, I developed a habit of pigging out at drive-thrus. When I rolled up alone to the window, I would pretend I was ordering for a few people by saying out loud, "What was it they wanted?" As if the clerk at the window cared. Clarity requires us to acknowledge what we're doing. Clarity of values also makes it possible to identify red herring habits. A red herring habit is a habit that we loudly claim to want to adopt when we don't actually intend to do so. Often, red herring habits reflect other people's values or priorities. I'm going to start cooking every night. I'm going to quit buying lottery tickets. Like tomorrow logic, red herring habits are dangerous because they allow us to fool ourselves about our actual intentions. As an upholder who takes all announced aims very seriously, perhaps too seriously, I get concerned when I suspect that I'm hearing someone declare a red herring habit. I became aware of red herring habits when I sat next to a man at a dinner party. "I'm going to start exercising," he said in an unconvincing tone. "I really need to." "Why don't you exercise?" I asked gingerly. "I don't have time and I travel so much. Also, my knee bothers me." "It sounds like maybe you don't really want to exercise." "Oh, I have to," he answered. "Periodically, my wife and kids try to get me started. I'm going to start soon." I understood. He didn't want to exercise, but he was using a red herring habit to pretend to his family and himself that he was going to start exercising. One of these days. Ironically, if my dinner partner had said, "My family is pressuring me, but I have no intention of exercising," the act of acknowledging his choice and its consequences might have led him to decide that he did want to exercise. By repeating a red herring, he avoided admitting his true intention, which allowed him to deny what he was doing. A friend used the strategy of clarity to avoid this trap. "I know it would be good to exercise," she told me, "but I have two kids, I work full-time, and if I tried to exercise, it would be one more thing to worry about. When my kids are older, I'll deal with it." "Great," I said. She looked relieved but also suspicious. "I thought you would try to convince me," she said. "To me, it seems better to say, 'At this point, I'm not going to worry about exercising,' than to keep saying, 'I should exercise,' but then never do it. Either way, you're not exercising, but because you have clarity about what you're doing, you feel in control, and you won't drain yourself feeling bad about it." Also, I predict her feeling of self-control will help her do better if she does decide to start exercising, because she won't tell herself, "I've been trying and failing for years to do this." What red herring habits do I have? I should entertain more. My mother loves to entertain and does it beautifully. I keep telling myself, "I will entertain," but then I don't. I keep saying, "I should put my dishes in the dishwasher instead of the sink," but I just put my dishes in the sink. Some red herring habits I've already abandoned. I'm going to make my daughters write thank you notes. I'm going to read a poem every night. I'm going to keep a record of everything I read on Goodreads. I'm going to use my good china. Someday I vow I will use my good china. But in the meantime, it's such a relief to give up this and other red herring habits. People in the four tendencies show different patterns with red herring habits. Upholders form fairly few red herring habits because they tend to take expectations very seriously and act on them unless they're clearly optional, like reading a poem every night. Questioners sometimes espouse red herring habits when they're not actually convinced that the proposed habit is sufficiently justified to deserve follow-through. Obligers claim red herring habits when they feel the pressure of others' expectations, but with no framework of accountability to push them into action. Rebels have no trouble saying, "Nope, I'm not going to do that," so red herring habits don't trouble them much. By providing clarity, or not, our words can make it easier or harder to keep a habit. People who use language that emphasizes that they're acting by their own choice and exercising control, "I don't," "I choose to," "I'm going to," or "I don't want to," stick to their habits better than people who use language that undermines their self-efficacy. I can't, I'm not allowed to, or I'm supposed to. There's a real difference between I don't and I can't. The very words we choose to characterize our habits can make them seem more or less appealing. Engagement time sounds more interesting than email time. Playing the piano sounds more fun than practicing the piano. And what sounds more attractive? A personal retreat day? Or a catch-up day? Or a ditch day? Or a mandatory vacation day? People of different tendencies would choose different terms. Would a person rather take a dance class or exercise? Some people like the word quit, as in, I've quit sugar. Some are put off by its overtones of addiction. A woman told me, I try not to use the words forever and never, but I like the word permanent. Many people report that they want to feel less stressed. But stress is a vague word, and because it doesn't pinpoint any concrete problems, it doesn't suggest any solutions. When I say, I'm stressed out, I blur the connection between the way I act and the way I feel. So, instead of saying, I'm stressed, I press myself to identify exactly what's bothering me. I work at home, so I feel as though I should be working all the time. I'm working with someone who drains my energy. I want us to have fun family adventures, but we all need a lot of downtime at home, too. I can't decide what opportunities to pursue. My laptop isn't syncing properly with my desktop. I get flustered when both my daughters talk at me at the same time. I feel awkward in this social situation. Once I've spelled out the problem in words, the greater clarity usually helps me to spot a solution. Besides clarity of values, another kind of clarity supports habit formation. Clarity of action. The more specific I am about what action to take, the more likely I am to form a habit. A habit to be more mindful, for instance, is too vague to be a habit. But have a moment of gratitude every time I walk into my apartment building, or take a photo of something interesting every day, are concrete actions that can become habits. Clarity of action is often a problem with medicine. Studies suggest that up to 55% of adults don't take their medicines as prescribed, and several of the top reasons for this failure reflect a lack of clarity. If people wonder, why should I bother to take these pills anyway? Or, when am I supposed to take those pills? Or, did I take my pills today? They're less likely to take them. That's why some of the old familiar pill bottles have been replaced by blister packs with compartments clearly labeled with the day of the week. To achieve greater clarity in my actions, I often invoke a bright line rule, a useful concept from law. A bright line rule is a clearly defined rule or standard that eliminates any need for interpretation or decision making. For example, observing the Sabbath, or using the New York Times Manual of Style and Usage to decide grammar questions, or never buying bottled water, or answering every email within 24 hours, or calling home every Sunday night, are bright line rules. One familiar bright line rule is the habit of making purchases only from a prepared list as a way to eliminate impulse shopping. A reader explained, I shop from a list, not only for groceries, but for clothing and cosmetics as well. This is not only to save money, but to avoid clutter. I already adhere to many bright line rules. I never use that instrument of torture, the snooze alarm. Eleanor and I leave for school at exactly 7:50 every morning. Jamie and I disagree about one bright line rule. I think that once you decide to go to an event, you go. Jamie has a more fluid view. I'm an upholder, he's a questioner. People have their own idiosyncratic bright line habits. I met a guy who told me that he was vegetarian before dinner. A friend told me, when I got married, I decided to say yes to sex whenever possible because our relationship would be better with more sex. Another friend told me, my habit is never to have more than three. of whatever. Three beers, three TV shows. How did you come up with this? I asked. Why three? I don't remember, she said. I followed this rule for as long as I can remember. What's scary is how faithfully I followed it as a kid. Unconventional, but effective. As an underbuyer, I very much dislike buying new clothes. And when I do have new things, I have to fight the impulse to save them, to keep them crisp and unused by continuing to wear my shabby clothes. I decided to make a bright line habit of throwing away anything that had a hole. To my surprise, this habit turned out to be an utter failure. I simply cannot throw something away simply because it has a hole. I'd coach myself. This is my new habit. Come on, into the trash with that sock. But I couldn't do it. Bright line rules work only if we follow them. One morning, as I was walking home after dropping Eleanor off at school, I had one of those rare moments of reflection when I stepped back from my daily concerns to take a more sweeping view of my actions. I was pouring energy into changing my habits, yet when I asked myself, what change would add more happiness to my life? None of my habits addressed an issue at the top of my list. I wanted to see my sister more often. The problem, I realized, was that I didn't have a time dedicated to Elizabeth. I see my parents frequently because I've set aside specific times to visit, at Christmas and in August. No decisions, no planning, just pick the dates and buy the plane tickets. I see my parents at other times as well, but I always see them at those times. Elizabeth and I didn't have this kind of standing plan. Every other year, we overlap in Kansas City for Christmas, and occasionally I go to Los Angeles for work, but that wasn't enough. Our plans never crystallized. When would we do it? Where would we go? Which family would travel? Too many decisions. No clarity, no action. Having identified the problem, I considered possible solutions. Elizabeth's and Adam's work schedules as TV writers are highly unpredictable. Summer is a very busy season for them. They have a young child. My family was on a much more predictable schedule. I came up with a proposal, and I called Elizabeth to discuss it. Listen, I said, I really wish we could get our two families together more often. I think we should have a standing plan where we get together once a year. That would be great, she said, but when? This is what I figured out. You and Adam don't have much control of your schedule, so we plan for President's Weekend, because that's a three-day weekend. And Eliza and Eleanor actually get 4 days. It may turn out that you have to work, but you'd have as good a chance then as with any other three-day weekend. We pick some great hotel within driving distance from L.A., so you don't have to buy airplane tickets. That way, if you have to cancel at the last minute, you won't lose a ton of money, and you won't spend much time making arrangements. Even if you three can't make it, the four of us will come anyway, and we'll have fun either way. So it's simple, with no stress if you have to cancel. But that means you guys have to fly all the way out here. Now that Eliza and Eleanor are older, it's not a big deal. It's a lot easier for us to travel than for you. And we'll enjoy California. And we do this every year, she said. If it works, we can stick to it. No decisions. Easy is more important than fabulous. Elizabeth and Adam both thought this sounded like a great idea, so I bought a guide to Southern California, we picked the Santa Barbara area as our destination, and we made our reservations. Flash forward. Elizabeth had to cancel because of work. Then, at the last minute, her schedule changed again, and she, Adam, and Jack were able to come. It worked perfectly. After that, I realized that I could tie other yearly habits to trigger dates, like President's Weekend. For instance, Labor Day now triggers me to schedule the family flu vaccine. St. Patrick's Day triggers me to review finances with Jamie. Green. A friend and I share the same birthday, and each year we have lunch to celebrate. I almost never see her otherwise, but knowing that I'll see her once a year helps maintain our friendship. Trigger dates also save me from feeling guilty. Because I won't worry about holiday shopping until after Thanksgiving, I don't feel guilty about not shopping earlier. Clarity. Around this time, I called Elizabeth for an update on the treadmill desk. It had made her life better than before to a gratifyingly dramatic degree. "I love it," she said. "I've walked almost 200 miles. "That's amazing," I said. I figured out it's really a key to controlling my blood sugar.